For the World's podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Running a small business is a lot of work. It takes time and money, and you want all the time and money you have to go towards growing your business. But what happens when legal hurdles pop up along the way? LegalZoom is there to help. Get advice for running your business from vetted independent attorneys and tax professionals available in all 50 states. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Russian meddling and what happens next time today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump may or may not admit it, but we know Russia interfered in the 2016 election. And 2020, this top Senate Democrat is worried.
The failure of this White House and this president in particular to recognize this national security threat is the most remarkable part of this story.
Also today, our reporter elbows his way through a market in Bangkok to figure out the connection between taste and language. Like, what do you call the mouth-puckering feel of a green banana?
We just don't have a word for it in English. And the word is bad.
Bad.
I can't explain, she says. Can someone else explain it to this guy?
Those stories and more today on The World. Eighteen words that flew around the world and then got deleted. President Trump's tweet today acknowledged that he did, in fact, benefit from Russia's interference in the 2016 election. Trump's actual text, "And now Russia has disappeared because I had nothing to do with Russia helping me to get elected." The syntax is classic Trump and just confusing enough that it lit Twitter up on fire. And then the president deleted it. No use, though. The internet lives forever. Democrat Mark Warner is vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. They've been investigating the president. I asked Warner, what does he make of all this?
Just when you think it can't get any weirder, it gets weirder. The president who has spent most of his 2 years in office saying it's a witch hunt, the president then flipping out on Mueller today and somehow saying, at least implicitly acknowledging that Russia was trying to help him, and now deleting that tweet, it leaves me, you know, more than scratching my head. But to me, the big takeaway from Mueller was where he started his comments and ended his comments yesterday, saying that Russia had massively intervened in our elections through attacking our electoral system, manipulating social media, hacking into personal information, and then weaponizing that information. And my takeaway, and what I've been trying to urge my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, we can debate about impeachment, but let's not debate about the fact that Russia, in all likelihood, or other countries, will be back, and we need to do more to protect our nation for 2020.
So let's put a pin in that, because I want to ask you about that in a moment. Just back to the tweet that was deleted, the president's tweet. Very quickly, Twitter reacted to that tweet, and then the president deleted it. What does that suggest to you? Is it like an official retraction of his statement, or I did not mean what you think kind of moment?
Trying to figure out Donald Trump's tweet theory or reasoning is well beyond my skill set. So I'm not – and I don't mean that glibly. I just am not sure what to read into it. I come back again, though, to the point that this president has been unwilling to acknowledge the Russian intervention. What it was even more outrageous was there were at least public reports that the then Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristen Nielsen, wanted to have a cabinet meeting on 2020 election security and was told not to do that because it might offend the sensibilities of Donald Trump. To me, that is outrageous when every branch of our intelligence community has all come out and said, Russia intervened, and as recently as 3 weeks ago, the FBI director said, in all likelihood, they or others will be back. And the failure of this White House and this president in particular to recognize this national security threat is the most remarkable part of this story and a part of the story that candidly has not garnered nearly enough attention.
I mean, what you're saying there, along with a lot of what a lot of people heard in Mueller's statement yesterday as a plea to the House of Representatives to take up impeachment, I'm just wondering, what was your interpretation?
I will leave that to the House. I will, you know, and candidly, I think Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker, has done a pretty good job of saying, let's continue to get more facts out and leave everything on the table. I would hope that Congress would take up legislation that I've offered and others have offered next week, much of it's bipartisan, one, to make sure that we protect our election system, and by that, by having a paper ballot trail after every vote so there is not an ability to lessen people's confidence in the voting system, two, to put some guardrails around the Facebook and other social media companies so there's not the ability to create the fake accounts and to manipulate at the level that we saw in 2016, or for that matter, that we saw not by Russians but by others blatantly last week, where there was manipulation of Speaker Pelosi's video speech. That tool will be even exacerbated next year by Russians or others. And three, even if we accept Mueller's conclusion that the over 140 contacts between Trump officials and the Russians didn't warrant a conspiracy charge, let's put a law in place that says if a foreign agent of any government tries to intervene in a federal election in the United States, there ought to be an affirmative obligation to report that to law enforcement. Tell the FBI.
Senator Warner, I know you've got to go, but are you on the side that believes a focus on Russia is the priority before and going into 2020?
I believe focus on Russia and, for that matter, other nations who will have seen the Russian playbook and use it. The one thing we should have been aware of was the tools Russia used against us, they also used against French in the French presidential elections, and they used in the Brexit vote. And if you add up what the Russians spent in our elections, the Brexit vote, and the French presidential election, less than the cost of one new F-35 airplane. So these tactics are cheap. They are effective. They have sown chaos throughout the West, and they will be back. And while we can debate impeachment, while we can debate obstruction, the one area that I think that is beyond dispute, at least from our intelligence community and from Bob Mueller, is that we need to do a better job of protecting our elections and the confidence that Americans have in our elections in 2020. And candidly, we have not done enough in that area.
Senator Mark Warner is on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Meanwhile, today, the president also backed up Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Trump spoke as he was boarding Marine One on his way to the Air Force Academy graduation.
Well, it's too bad what happened in Israel. It looked like a total win for Netanyahu. He's a great guy. He's a great guy.
What happened in Israel that Trump was bemoaning? Netanyahu failed to form a coalition government, so lawmakers voted last night to dissolve parliament. It's the first time that's ever happened in Israeli history. So there's going to be a redo of the national elections that were just held in April, with fresh elections now planned for September. Michael Koplow is the policy director at the Israel Policy Forum in Washington. What did happen last night, Michael? Why couldn't Netanyahu form a coalition?
Netanyahu couldn't form a coalition because he's in a situation where he needed every single party in his prospective coalition to agree. He had no wiggle room, because after last election, he was left with 65 seats in the right-wing and ultra-Orthodox bloc. And so he needed every single one of those parties to agree to join the government. And there was a dispute between two of those parties, a secular party led by Avigdor Lieberman and an ultra-Orthodox party, over the draft of ultra-Orthodox men into the Israeli army. And once those two outside parties couldn't agree on a compromise for the draft law, it meant that Netanyahu was facing a situation where he could either dissolve the Knesset and go to new elections, or run the risk of having Israel's president give someone else the chance to form a government, and he elected to dissolve the Knesset.
Netanyahu called what happened last night a little event. I mean, is it insignificant? Why is he downplaying what happened?
There is absolutely nothing little or insignificant about it. It's important to note that this was the first time that this has happened in Israel's 71-year history. It's also important to note that Netanyahu himself has been so successful because he is seen by many Israelis as being indispensable and irreplaceable, and as the only person who can serve as prime minister and really sit atop Israeli politics and wrangle all of the parties that he needs to wrangle and still maintain Israel's position in the world. And this is the first time during this tenure that he has failed politically in a very visible and very embarrassing way.
Avigdor Lieberman, the leader of that secular party you mentioned, in a statement today, Netanyahu called him out. Netanyahu said Lieberman is obsessed with sabotaging right-wing governments. Was Lieberman's support really that critical here?
Lieberman's support was not only critical, but necessary, because without the 5 seats that Lieberman brought to the table, Netanyahu was left with only 60 seats, and you need 61 seats to form a coalition in the Knesset. And so Netanyahu couldn't afford to lose Lieberman. He was literally being held hostage, not only to Lieberman, but to every other party in his prospective coalition. The question of whether Lieberman is out to bring down right-wing governments is an interesting one. I don't think that any observer of Israeli politics would ever term Avigdor Lieberman as anything but right-wing. He is somebody who's known as being extremely hawkish, and he's somebody who's known as having a serious authoritarian streak. And so to describe him as somebody who's looking to bring down right-wing governments, I think, is a stretch, but there is definitely bad blood that dates back years.
There's a poll that's just out that suggests the results in September will be the same as April. I mean, what do you think is really going to change?
So, you know, the polls that have come out today obviously, came out with even less than 24 hours for people to absorb the news. And so I don't assume that they will stay the same. If they do stay the same, then Netanyahu is literally right back at square one, where he needs the same two outside parties, Lieberman and the ultra-Orthodox, to agree on this military draft law. And obviously they weren't able to do it this time. There's no reason to think that they will be able to do it next time. So there's really no way of knowing what's going to happen on September 17th. The only thing that certainly is known is that the next 3.5 months are probably going to be an even nastier campaign than we saw last time.
Certainly an inauspicious day for Jared Kushner, Trump's advisor on the Mideast, to arrive in Israel. Got there today. He's supposed to be driving a new Mideast peace plan. What does this domestic Israeli political drama do to any efforts at peace between Israelis and Palestinians?
I think it likely means that the Trump peace initiative, which was a long shot to begin with, is now officially dead and buried. There's no scenario in which Netanyahu wants to be running for prime minister again with a Trump peace plan out there. A number of the members of his prospective coalition who are farther to his right publicly announced during the last campaign and during these coalition negotiations that they're very thankful for everything President Trump has done for Israel, but that they don't want to see a peace plan. They see no reason to make any concessions to the Palestinians at all, no matter how small, and that they view this as being unhelpful. And so I think the combination of this new election in Israel and then the presidential election season in the United States, combined with all of the other obstacles that were in this peace plan's path to begin with, I think probably guarantees that we're not going to see it.
Apparently, Kushner brought Netanyahu a map from President Trump showing the annexed Golan Heights as part of Israel. Trump wrote "nice" on the map. But after what happened to the prime minister last night, do you think that even brightened his day?
Well, I think to the extent that it brightened his day, it tells him that he is going to have President Trump's assistance in this campaign, much like he did in the last campaign, when he got a number of goodies from the president, including that recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, and including some tweets on from President Trump tacitly endorsing Netanyahu. So I think he can probably guarantee on having the president's help for the next 3.5 months to try to remain as prime minister.
All right, we'll leave it there. Michael Coppola, the policy director at the Israel Policy Forum in Washington. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
What Islam and Sharia law have to say about nuclear weapons, that's up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Last night, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said something we found surprising. The Ayatollah said that Iran is not looking to acquire nuclear weapons, and not because of sanctions or American actions, but because nuclear weapons are forbidden under Islamic Sharia law. Not sure how that squares with Iran's actions over the past few years. After all, successive U.S. administrations have warned about the threat of the Islamic Republic's nuclear program and that it had to be stopped, hence the nuclear deal with Tehran. So the idea that Islamic law would supersede all that and stop Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, that caught our attention, and we decided to check it out. Omid Safi is a professor of Iranian studies at Duke University and the director of the Duke Islamic Studies Center. So Iran is officially an Islamic republic. Does Islam forbid the use of nuclear weapons?
So I think it's good to start by realizing that when the Quran is revealed in the 7th century, there are no nuclear weapons in the world. The Quran, nor the Bible, nor the Torah, none of them say anything about nuclear weaponry, chemical weaponry, biological weaponry. What the Quran has and what the Islamic tradition has had over the last 1400 years is a clear emphasis on what it calls the sanctity and the dignity of human life. So what Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme ruler of Iran, is doing is that in 2010, almost 10 years ago, he issued a juridical opinion stating that weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, and biological, are against the rulings of Islamic law.
It did make me scratch my head, this statement from the Ayatollah, because, I mean, if nuclear weapons are forbidden under Islamic Sharia law, I mean, did it make you wonder what the Iran nuclear deal was really all about?
Well, the Iran nuclear deal was very specifically to make sure that Iran's nuclear energy capabilities remained at the level of nuclear energy and never was allowed to be enriched to the point of developing nuclear weaponry.
Right. But if the Ayatollah says we actually don't want them anyway because it's forbidden, then it seems like the JCPOA was a lot of work for, I mean, was it necessary?
It was necessary in order to lift crushing and crippling sanctions imposed largely by the United States in alliance with our global powers and allies upon Iran. The sanctions have had a crippling impact on everything from medicine to industry to airplane parts, and has really isolated Iran economically, which has led to a level of inflation in Iran that every Iranian complains about.
Professor Safi, why do you think the Ayatollah made this statement now?
The Ayatollah has been making this statement for the last 10 years or so. I think they find themselves at a time where they're dealing with an unstable American president. It is very difficult to think about what the actual policy of the United States in the region consists of. We're also seeing the rise of dictatorial and authoritarian regimes all around the world, whether you're talking about Putin and Modi and Sisi and Erdogan and Netanyahu and Trump and Boris Johnson. We're dealing with a rise of anti-democratic movements all around the world. Mm. Bashar al-Assad in Syria and so many, too many others to name. So I think the rulers of Iran, who have a fascinating way of speaking in very adversarial way, but actually negotiating on very pragmatic and diplomatic ways, I think they are trying to get America and whatever global power is still left back to the negotiating table so that another deal can be worked out.
We're speaking with Omid Safi, he's professor of Iranian studies at Duke University, about Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, and his fatwa against the use of nuclear weapons. So as to the Ayatollah statement, if it's all about human life and dignity, this ban on nuclear weapons, how well does Iran do on other aspects of human life and dignity?
Well, it's a mixed record, as are the majority of the countries in the region. I think what we have to deal with in the case of Iran, it's a developing democracy where the majority of the population, being under 30 years old, are voting for a moderate candidate, and they're dealing with an 80-plus-year-old supreme leader who will have to be replaced at some point. So I think the question for Iran, being an ancient and proud civilization, being this democracy in progress, when their hardline ruler says, we have no interest in nuclear weaponry. And please bring the United Nations, bring the global powers, verify that we're not developing nuclear weaponry. I think this represents an extraordinary opportunity for anybody in the world that would like to see a path other than warfare and destruction.
Earlier this week, the foreign minister of Iran responded to a question about nuclear weapons, and he said Ayatollah Khamenei long ago said we're not seeking nuclear weapons by issuing a fatwa banning them. Professor Safi, we hear the word fatwa a lot. Explain how that applies in matters of national defense. Can a fatwa be revoked?
Well, so the fatwa is simply the opinion of a jurist. Not anybody can issue a fatwa. It is not as if you and I could just open up our own website and start issuing fatwas. An analogy would be that not anybody can issue a Supreme Court decision. You have to become an attorney and a judge and be appointed to the Supreme Court, and a case has to be brought in front of you, and then you rule on the basis of that.
But you could imagine a situation where the 80-some-odd-year-old Ayatollah is replaced by somebody who may be more in line with the political leanings toward building nuclear weapons.
I think the reason that I have a hard time seeing that being the case is that the underlying principle, which is the sanctity of human life, that part is enshrined in Islamic law. So it's true that the Islamic tradition, no more than the Christian tradition or the Jewish tradition, these have never been pacifist traditions as a whole. They've all had a notion of, if you would, a just war, which specify the terms and the conditions that have to be met in order for you to go to war, how you conduct yourself in war, and most importantly, how you get yourself out of war. And it's possible that some of those terms and conditions could be defined and redefined with the passage of time. What I have a hard, as somebody who studies this tradition every day, what I have a hard time seeing happen is that a new qualified jurist would all of a sudden say, indiscriminate killing of civilians, which is what weapons of mass destruction are designed to do, of the type that the United States put on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that all of a sudden the indiscriminate killing of civilians is permissible under the letter, if not the spirit, of Islamic law. I think that really flies in the face of everything that we know about a 1,400-year juridical tradition.
Professor Omid Safi speaking with us from Duke University. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
A quick correction to a story we brought you yesterday about ISIS and the persecution of the Yazidis in northern Iraq. We incorrectly described the Yazidis as a Christian minority. The Yazidis, in fact, have their own monotheistic religion. Coming up on The World, a 93-year-old journalist who remembers firsthand the Japanese internment camps during World War II. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Angela Merkel's time as Germany's leader is winding down. Her stature as a global leader will be difficult for anyone to match.
For someone who is now such a powerful player as Angela Merkel is, wields power in Europe and across the world, that seems like an anachronism.
We look at Merkel's legacy coming up here on The World. Congratulations to the 989 cadets who graduated from the United States Air Force Academy today. President Trump was their commencement speaker, and he had an America First message for them.
And we're restoring the fundamental principle that our first obligation and highest loyalty is to the American citizen. No longer will we sacrifice America's interests to any foreign power. We don't do that anymore.
Across the country, here in Massachusetts, German Chancellor Angela Merkel also delivered a commencement address to the graduates at Harvard University.
Veränderungen zum Guten sind möglich, wenn wir sie gemeinsam angehen.
Changes for the better are possible if we tackle them together.
In Alleingängen wird das nicht gelingen.
If we were to go it alone, we could not achieve much.
Mehr denn je müssen wir multilateral statt unilateral denken und handeln.
More than ever, our way of thinking and our actions have to be multilateral rather than unilateral.
Two very different worldviews there. Merkel's trip to the U.S. comes as her decade and a half in power is winding down. The World's Matthew Bell looks back at the German leader's legacy.
It's the sort of nickname that wouldn't fly these days, but it's also an indication of how far Angela Merkel has come since she started out working with her political mentor, the former chancellor, Helmut Kohl.
He called her Mein Mädchen, which in this day and age of Me Too, we would never tolerate because the translation is my little girl.
Catherine Kluver Ashbrook is at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
For someone who is now such a powerful player as Angela Merkel is, that seems like an anachronism.
Kluver Ashbrook, who's also a German citizen, says the leader of the free world title is one that Angela Merkel has never really embraced herself. It's something people started calling her for the way she handled a newly elected President Trump.
She said, there is a principled part of my leadership that we will continue to honor, and if that means pushing back against this administration, we will.
Merkel grew up outside of Berlin in the former East Germany, the daughter of a Protestant pastor. In 1990, she was deputy spokesman for the East German government. After reunification, Merkel went on to become minister for the environment. In 2005, she became Germany's first female chancellor. She's always been known as a savvy and careful politician, but two of her most significant decisions were quite radical. One was in 2011. To transform the German economy by phasing out nuclear power.
That will definitely be a legacy item of hers. We call it in German the Energiewende, the radical switch in how Germany does its energy policy, which is all linked to climate change. And that was something that she decided upon after the Fukushima accidents. She said right away, look, this is where we need to make a drastic change.
Merkel's other radical move came in 2015, when she essentially decided to open Germany's borders to hundreds of thousands of migrants from Syria and beyond.
Germany has been very lucky after the disasters of the past to have the right chancellor for the right moment.
Karl Kaiser spent many years as a political advisor in Germany, and he's also a fellow at Harvard. He says Merkel showed the rest of the world how a moral leader responds to a crisis.
A Germany that has the Nazi regime and the Holocaust in its past had to open when thousands and thousands of women, children, and men were at the border of Germany, and she did the right thing. Had she closed the border, it would have been a disaster for the country.
But inside Germany, the story of the migrant crisis is complicated. Julianne Smith is an analyst with the Center for a New American Security. She's based in Berlin. Smith says the data show that many of the migrants who've settled in Germany in the last few years are doing well, integrating, beginning successful new lives.
But the perception is that these refugees are going to create future challenges for Germany, namely that these refugees will be taking away jobs that are reserved for Germans.
And that has been a political gift to the far right, not just in Germany, but elsewhere in Europe. Angela Merkel's legacy is also her endurance, says Daniel Dresner of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
Whatever you think, and there's a lot to criticize in terms of Merkel's legacy, Germany as a whole did relatively well despite the most serious financial crisis in 100 years.
Dresner says other parts of Europe did less well, in part because of policies pushed by Merkel at that moment of crisis.
In some ways, Merkel's greatest legacy was her insistence about a year after the 2008 financial crisis of the need for austerity as a way to arrest the crises in Greece and in other southern European countries. And that proved to be an unmitigated disaster.
For all the talk about immigration being a catalyst in the rise of the populist right in Europe, Dresner says the pain caused by fiscal austerity played an important role there, too. When I asked experts who will take over for Merkel as the future leader of the free world when she ends her time in office, one name that came up was Emmanuel Macron. The president of France has tried to articulate a vision for the future of Europe as a successful multi-state project for peace and prosperity. But Macron is very unpopular at home, so he has nothing like the political mandate that Merkel has had for over a decade. Then there's Merkel's apparent political successor. Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer's nickname is AKK. She's expected to take over leadership of Merkel's party next year, but AKK has been struggling in the polls, and the same goes for most parties in the political center. In Germany and elsewhere in Europe, it's parties from the far left and the far right that seem to be gaining strength. So it's not just that there isn't another Angela Merkel waiting in the wings. It's that the conditions for a global leader like her just aren't there right now. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
There are a few countries where getting online is notoriously difficult. Cuba is one of them. But that's been changing. Yesterday, the government in Havana announced it will relax rules around Wi-Fi networks in the country, making it easier for people to access the internet from their own homes. Some Cubans are already doing it, but it's not so easy. Take a listen to an interview I was trying to do this morning. How do Cubans like you get online? Like right now, you're on WhatsApp. How did you connect with us? We did get Ariel Montenegro back on the line. He's a blogger based in Havana, and we wanted to know what it will be like come July when the new rules go into effect and Cubans can get online from home legally. He told us that for Cubans, looser rules around Wi-Fi networks are about way more than being able to access the internet. It'll mean that people can set up networks and share things with one another, even if they're not online.
There is a lot of things that Cubans access, but they don't access online. This is a strange concept to understand outside Cuba because people are used to do everything online on the internet. You watch, your TV shows on Netflix or on HBO or whatever, right?
Right.
Online, in the online services. Cubans cannot access that. In Cuba, we have this thing called El Paquete, which is the way that people get access to the digital content, like movies, video games, stuff like that.
It's really simple, and it's basically people sharing flash drives, right?
Exactly. It's a flash drive. So in Cuba, people buy this. They go to the guy's house with a thumb drive, and they buy that. Or the guy comes to your place, and he brings that. Now, with these legal networks, you can buy that from your house. You don't have to go to the guy's house anymore, for example. And that's really interesting, you know?
Yeah, what's kind of odd is that you're talking about a number of improvements that the Cuban government has made to accessing the internet in Cuba, and yet people are still using El Paquete, this TV shows games on thrown onto flash drives
like
and traded around.
For a long time. It's going to be like that for a long time because these new rules is not going to be like another internet providers or private internet providers. The Cuban government is still going to be the sole internet provider in Cuba. This new regulation for the government, what that allows is more connectivity between people to people, or people to people share their own content or the content that come in El Paquete or to play video games. People has been doing that for years now, and it was not legal. The government looked the other way, but they were not allowed.
So bottom line, come July 29th, what people see on the internet in Cuba still will go through the Cuban government.
Yes, exactly. The Cuban government will be the sole provider of internet. This telecommunication company called Etexa is going to be the sole provider of internet in Cuba for people, for Wi-Fi spot, to people houses, to everybody.
Well, like I said earlier, the sound quality of this interview shows how much work the Cuban government still needs to do on internet access.
Ariel, sorry, I hope I helped a little bit.
Ariel Montenegro, a blogger speaking with us from Havana. Thank you very much, Ariel.
Okay, you're welcome. Bye.
Central American migrant children are not the first kids that the U.S. government has kept behind barbed wire.
My little brother's first bed was the trough that the horses ate from. Times were very, very rough.
Maggie Ishino is one of fewer than 20,000 people alive today who remember firsthand when the U.S. mass incarcerated its own citizens. 7 decades ago, about 120,000 Japanese Americans were forced to live in detention camps during World War II. Now, at a time of widespread attention to child detentions in the U.S., many in the Japanese American community feel new urgency to preserve the stories of survivors before they have all died. Reporter Daniela Gerson takes us to Los Angeles.
My name is Maggie Ishino, and I am 93 years old.
Twice a week, fiercely independent Maggie Ishino takes an hour and a half bus ride across L.A. to get to her job in the Little Tokyo neighborhood.
It takes 3 buses to get to work and 3 buses to come home.
She's a writer at Raffo Shimpo. It's a small paper that's covered the local Japanese-American community for more than a century.
Good morning. Yes. Good morning. Good morning. When you take the top magazine, list under your name.
Ishino arrives to work with her cane and wearing her signature pearls. She doesn't have children, but she's the newspaper's anointed grandmother. On her desk, she's got her dictionary.
I always have a dictionary handy on my desk. I don't think that there's an excuse for misspelling.
There's also a stack of letters from readers. Ishino's known for her popular column called Maggie's Meow. In it, she shares frank observations, like about the trendy young men she sees on the bus, with beards that look like, quote, a lion with an undeveloped mane. Sometimes she also writes about what she calls camp. Not summer camp, but where she was sent as a teenager in 1942, after Pearl Harbor. The U.S. feared that Japanese Americans could threaten national security. Never mind that Ishino was a U.S. citizen who'd never been to Japan. She was forced from her home in San Diego to live in converted horse stables at a racetrack near L.A.
And so there was a soldier. He pointed his bayonet at me and he said, get back in line. And that memory of the pointing the gun still stays with me.
After months at the horse tracks, called the assembly center, Ishino's family was sent to large incarceration camps in Arizona, in the desert, behind barbed wire.
It was an experience that so many people don't even know about it today, and it's a shame. And yet, I think that we should just forget about it because it's past, and it's, as I said, it's done did.
A lot of these folks did not want to talk about it for the longest time. So a lot of folks ended up taking it to the grave with them.
Mario Gershom Reyes is a photographer at Rafu Shimpo, the paper Ishino works at. And for decades, he's documented how Japanese Americans rebuilt their lives after incarceration. He's Mexican-American and didn't have family ties to the camps.
When I first started, of course, I didn't know anything about this history. You just couldn't believe that this government did this to its own citizens.
Recently, Reyes photographed a Memorial Day for the internment camps. Organizers read the names of the camps and how many people were incarcerated.
Houston, Arizona, 17,814.
Rower, Arkansas, 8,475.
And we realize that with each passing year, we have fewer and fewer who are able to attend. But are there other incarcerees or veterans here today? So please stand. We honor you and we thank you.
Only a handful of people stood up.
They're dying out. Okay, they're passing on.
That's Reyes, the photographer, again.
But what's gratifying is that we are recording those histories. Their story will live on, and their story will not be forgotten.
Back at the newsroom, Ishino is ready to go home. Two colleagues escort her to the bus.
Hey, let's go.
Not far from here is the site where Japanese American families, like Maggie Ishino's, were ordered to report to during World War II. But today, the focus is on getting Ishino on her bus home.
Hello, here comes Maggie.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, Mags. We'll see you on Monday, yeah?
For The World, Daniela Gerson, Los Angeles.
The Rafu Shimpo has come a long way since its shutdown in the 1940s, when its own staff was incarcerated during World War II. Read more about its evolution at theworld.org. Hey there, World podcast listener. We're creating a newsletter to help keep all of you up to date with everything we're doing in the world's newsroom. We want you to tell us what you think would be most interesting, most useful for you in a newsletter from The World. So I'm looking at you superfans to help us out and be a part of The World's newsletter focus group. I know you are some of the smartest listeners out there, so your input will be really important to have. Don't worry, it won't take a lot of time. Just send us an email to myworld@theworld.org and write newsletter in the subject line. That's myworld@theworld.org. And thanks. Sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and umami. You know those tastes. But how good you are at identifying them can actually depend on where you live. According to a new study, there is one group of people who are off the charts amazing at identifying flavors. They're Laotians, and their ability to discern so many specific flavors and tastes is reflected in their language, Lao. English has nothing on this. The World's Patrick Nguyen tracked down some Lao speakers in Bangkok to help him understand the flavors these words describe.
Klang Thai Market in Bangkok. They have everything here. Cool place to explore if you don't mind getting a little blood on your shoes. I pass by fish still squirming on wooden chopping blocks, and some ducks in iron cages. Okay, this is what I was looking for. A back corner where they sell hard-to-find herbs, many native to Laos, which is just north of Thailand. The women here speak a variety of Lao called Isan, and I come seeking their wisdom because there's this Lao word for a taste that, well, we just don't have a word for it in English. And the word is fad.
Nope. Go chat fad, cool like that.
I'm asking an herb vendor and yelling because it's loud how to describe fad.
Fad.
I can't explain, she says. Can someone else explain it to this guy? She's at a loss for words. And you might be too, if someone said, describe salty, a taste you've known all your life. An older vendor comes over, named Suni, and she just points to a bundle of leaves and says, you want fat? Go ahead, eat that. Okay, I get it now. All right, imagine biting into an unripe green banana, that dry mouth-puckering sensation. That is fat. You could say astringent, but that's not quite right. Turns out, Lao speakers have lots of flavor words like this, words that we just don't have in English.
The language gives you these finer gradations of taste-related experience.
That is Nick Enfield, linguistics professor at the University of Sydney. He has studied Lao for decades. And a while back, he went to this Lao village to do blind taste tests, giving people eyedroppers full of liquid sugar and then salt and citric acid and quinine, which is in tonic water, and finally MSG, just to see if they could name them as sweet, salty, sour, bitter, umami.
They literally just have a taste of something and then tell you how they would describe it in their language.
Meanwhile, dozens of other researchers did the same thing for languages all around the world, 20 total. They went to Hong Kong. They went to the jungles of Papua New Guinea. And they went to Texas. And it turns out, among all of these languages, Lao speakers were off the charts good at this exercise. Cantonese speakers, also good. Tzeltal, a Mayan language, strong showing. Farsi, very good. But Lao, amazing. English speakers, not good at all. In fact, the only people who did worse than English speakers on the taste test were speakers of an Australian Aboriginal language called Umpila and users of American and British Sign Language. English speakers would often confuse bitter and sour. And when it comes to umami,
we really don't have any way of talking about that in English at all. You know, here in this conversation, we're using the word umami. You know, that's a Japanese word.
But Lao, like Japanese, has that umami word. It's nua. The study looked at the five basic tastes, but Lao can go much deeper with its vocabulary. It's like when it comes to flavor, they're working with the 64 crayon box and English speakers, we got the 8-pack. Okay, maybe not that drastic. English speakers can convey taste just fine, especially if you give us enough time to explain. The trouble is, many English speakers have not been around as many flavors, and our language reflects that, where Lao, it's just more adept at summing up certain flavors in a single word. Lao speakers don't have magic powers, and nor does their language. What they do have is a tradition of eating lots of flavorful plants and herbs that are not eaten in the West.
Some of them will be very bitter, some of them will be kind of minty and give you these tingly sensations.
These sensations help hone the language, creating more precise words. Words like hun, that's another Lao word, describing a flavor that I just don't quite get. So, back to the market. I ask one of the herb sellers about hun. She says hun is like, it's like a flavor that shoots up your nose. Once again, they say, look, here's some leaves, just eat them.
Oh, you know what it tastes like? Wasabi. Like a very leafy, herbal wasabi. Goes right into your sinuses. Yeah, this, I've heard of mouth feel before. This has nose feel, but it's not unpleasant. In fact, it's kind of munchable.
And there you have it. Anyone can experience this flavor. We all have tongues, but language matters. Took me about 40 words to explain hun, but Lao speakers, they can knock it out in one syllable. For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Klong Toei Market, Bangkok.
Here's something that needs no lengthy explanation, regardless of language. The power ballad. Even in Laos, it still has a soft acoustic guitar introduction leading up to the big drums and fat chords. This is Laotian musician Ernoy Nifon. Call his sound power ballad Laotian country music. And since country music is known for its stories, here's a story in Ernoy's song. It's about a young Laotian man who works as a car mechanic. He's embarrassed when he's attracted to a young woman who doesn't return his advances. But later, in a market, not unlike the market Patrick was visiting, the mechanic stops a thief who steals the young woman's purse. Guess what happens next? Yes, the young woman suddenly sees the mechanic as her hero. They fall in love.
RI, Public Radio International.